You know, we've talked several times about the Marvel Cinematic Universe, MCU. That's a new multi-billion dollar comic book graphic novel empire. Of course, they're trying to move in technology stories like everybody else. And they've got a new movie coming out. It's starring Wonder Woman and Spider-Man. They go into business doing technology. Their product's going to be called Amazon Web Services. Hey guys, this is Daniel Markham, your Nerd Roundup. If you have never been to a Nerd Roundup before, well, you're in for a treat today, my friends, because Nerd Roundup is a thing where we get together once a week and talk about tech stories. Every week I keep sort of an open cam for top 10 friends that are nerdy and like talking, and they drop by and we talk about stories of the week. There are no rules, we just try to have fun. I think a team that can goof off and have fun together can do about damn near anything. And this week we've got John Kern and Greg Young, and I think maybe James will be dropping by, I'm not sure. Hey guys, where have you been? What's been going on? Let me get your camera on screen. Greg, what you been up to this week?
Oh, I was just giving you a joke that you didn't use.
Hey, you might not know it. There's a lot of competition for the jokes every week. You can probably tell from the quality. It's a...
I'll go off with it anyway. So what did Pavlov's dog say to Schrodinger's cat?
I give up.
Rorschach or bust, I don't know.
You would have had to been there.
Oh. It's a good one.
Yeah, somebody said, could you recognize Pavlov? And he said, no, but his face sure rings a bell. Badge.
Got another good one. I cannot compete. I have to pull up my company Slack channel on dad jokes to compete.
You actually have a Slack channel on dad jokes.
Correct.
That says something right there.
This sounds like the kind of place I want to go work for.
Yeah, probably.
Mm-hmm. John, what have you been up to this week?
Well, had some fascinating two half days of workshops with one of our development teams. And we were able to get into some good, constructive, actual sort of not conflict averse, but rather conflict embracing discussions about kind of getting at some parts of their process and how they currently work. So that was fascinating and fantastic to see, you know, the group being able to dig into some things that, you know, because what we try to do is just get people a little uncomfortable, but not so uncomfortable that they just tune out, right? So there's a fine balance of it all blows up and goes to hell. And you just ask just on the leading edge of their developmental capabilities.
There's actually a term for this that medical doctors use when they're treating patients, that we're going to bring you right to the line of uncomfortability, but we're not going to put you over that line.
Yeah, and this is I don't know what the name of it is, but it has to do with kind of your developmental edge, as it's said, and you know, by this scientist in this area. But yeah, so we did that. That was fun. And as you know, I started watching Stranger Things at the behest of a couple of my kids. And you're right. I'm gonna like it. So I binged watched it. I'm already on season 3, episode 1. So it's a terrible thing to get stuck into, but I'll power through it.
Yeah, welcome to the dark side.
Yeah, I haven't watched anything in years. Or played like Age of Empires in years or anything that I know that's addictive behavior. And suddenly my day job and my side job and my school board job take, you know, and there's a family thing, you know, take like fourth seat. So.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. I work alone a lot of times, so I'll turn the TV on. So I've been like doing a bunch of streaming, but I found that I stopped paying attention to what's happening. I had the TV on for like 6 hours where I was coding yesterday. I have no idea. I watched a whole season. I don't even know what the hell is going on. It's weird.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. What other things you've been up to?
I, I tried to pull up a Google search on this, and I just learned two new words.
I am afraid to ask.
So, paraphimosis and phimosis.
Is one dipped in wax?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You probably don't want to know what these are. And I have put into Google, doctor's treatment pullback, too much pain terminology.
Oh, oh boy.
That's and a scary one.
Paraphimosis is referring to when the foreskin is stuck behind the head of the penis. How did this even come up?
Well, at least it's better than like Mangala or something. I was getting even more worried when you told me there's search terms.
Did I tell you guys the Louis the 15th story?
Oh, God.
Okay.
Go for it.
Okay, so Louis the 15th, the last king of France before they beheaded him, he was married, of course, to Marie Antoinette, and he was a normal guy. I mean, he was heterosexual, but he had a, I think this thing Greg was talking about, the penile dosis thing or whatever it was, and it was very painful to have sex. And so we got married, and he was unable to consummate the marriage, which I guess these things happen, but it was, what, 1810. And so Marie Antoinette, being a princess, wrote a letter to her parents, the king, I think in Spain. They sent her brother to France to watch the marital act in progress to report back what was going on because they didn't have doctors.
And so, like, for consult?
Yeah, so he consulted on his sister's sex. I watched the whole thing, wrote it down, and sent the letter back to his parents. And
wow.
Well, and it got much more complicated after that. I mean, they completely lost their heads.
Yeah, it did. Yeah, just talk about some awkward situations. I don't know.
But yeah, that would be one.
Yeah, fortunately, he got the little head fixed before he lost the big one, so things worked out in the end for him. So this past week, I have been busy as a beaver, programming Pandoc and Obsidian and just having fun with text slicing and dicing and all sorts of goodness. I've started on a new book, and that first step of that book is to waste a lot of time with tech tools. So in that process of wasting a lot of time right now, plan on getting to actual writing at some point next year, but right now it's a lot of tool stuff, a lot of tools.
That's funny. Pandoc sounds familiar. It's part of the firefighting app, Placemark. You can optionally print out your structural, your building pre-plans in a PDF. And I think now I'm just using it probably HTML to PDF, but is Pandoc something like that where you can construct a document? Because I think it sounds really familiar, like I looked at that technology.
Yes, you probably heard James and I talking about FFmpeg, which is like a Swiss Army knife of video formats. Well, Pandoc is the same thing for text formats. And so I put off FFmpeg for a long time until we started doing this podcast. And I just love it now. I'll probably use it the rest of my life. Same thing with Pandoc. I've been new to Pandoc for 10 years, but I'm like, I don't want to do, don't want to know. It's like a 200-page manual. And so finally, I just kind of bit the bullet and read the whole manual and spent a lot of time learning how to translate text files around.
Okay, well, maybe I'll pick your brain or just follow along as you either succeed or throw it out the door.
Yeah, it's not as exciting as it sounds.
No, yeah. Structured content and turned it into a freaking document without using Microsoft Word. Yeah.
Yeah. This guy, he wrote Pandoc in Haskell, but of course Haskell. And they say there's this hugely complicated diagram that you go to the website. There's like 40 different input, 40 different output formats. And anybody who's done data stuff for a while realizes that you can't just translate any format to any format. You're going to lose information. And so you have to figure out which are the two translation matrices that has the less information loss. That's the trick there, right?
Yeah, I used to talk to people about that because I remember like Rational Rose UML modeling and TogetherSoft UML modeling. And there was the lingua franca, I forget, like object XML, whatever the hell it was called. And I would say, well, you know what, each tool has unique things that don't translate there. And so you get the least common denominator if you try to.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
that the system doesn't know.
That's funny because the guy who wrote Obsidian, which is one of my tools, is the same guy who helped write Markdown. Markdown's the thing people use to write websites.
Oh, yeah.
And mm-hmm. so, yeah, I'm like, I'm using LingPub right now with Markdown to do books. I'm using this tool with Markdown to do notes. Markdown, tool.
Yeah.
Well, it should work. There. He, the guy who did the spec, added three new things to his Markdown, and the LingPub guys are developing their whole freaking other system. They started with Markdown, and they're just kind of wandering the field doing what the fuck they want to do. And so you got to say, well, do I want lock-in here? Do I want lock-in? I told a friend of mine, I said, we're going to go do some standards work. And he said, you know, I love standards. Everybody's got one.
Right.
He's like, yeah, they're great.
That's my joke. Yeah.
So, yeah, I learned a lot. I got it all working. And Obsidian, by the way, is the coolest thing since sliced bread.
Let's check it out.
Yeah, I want you to demo sometime for you guys. It is the best research tool I've used. So the first article is code bloat has become astronomical, and this amazes me. I mean, I'm one who complains. I'm one of these old dudes like, yeah, they're just doing too much programming anymore. But this guy, he had to upload a file from a website, and he had to download 230 megabytes of code, 2,700 different files, to upload a file to a web server.
What? That seems legit.
I shit you not. No, yeah, you're right. That is, it's like we complain when things went past a megabyte and everybody laughed, and we complain went past a gigabyte. And it's like, you don't realize this is never, ever going to stop. We're going to be like downloading 4 terabyte. Yeah, there's no limit to this thing. This is amazing.
Yeah.
And yet, we used to write code that would fit in 1 kilobyte.
I could write a file upload right now, a kilobyte probably, because it's a one line of JavaScript and it's like a CGI program on a web server somewhere.
No, because if you write it in JavaScript, then we have to count the entire JavaScript runtime.
We only count things I mess with. We don't count everything else. It's the only thing that's going to work. That's just, wow, that's amazing. That's just, what amazes me even more is that the internet has been uploading files for a long time. So you got, like I said, one line of JavaScript uploads from the client. And on the server side, it's the same damn thing. These are very, very common things that have been coded. Yet we need 230 megabytes of bullshit. And what could go wrong?
Yeah.
So, Greg, you like this next story. You want to talk about it? It's the AI story.
Oh, this one is fun. So the fun thing about this is that AI usually cannot explain its own decisions.
Does it get more fun after this?
Well, what's fun with it is that AI, so if we were to consider like a neural network, we can use backtracking on it to see which things were set off, and we can kind of work out why they were set off.
Yes.
But having an AI looking at decisions of somebody else who is perhaps a human, we really don't know why they made that decision.
Yes.
Until we start getting into this whole backtracking process. Yes. And it can be that there were legitimate reasons that this decision was made, and it can be that it actually found the color black at pixel 422 in the image that was put in as input 3.
There's a video of a guy who's holding I think it's a muffin, and he holds it up and the computer says muffin and muffin, muffin. He turns it just the right way. It goes Barack Obama.
Did it have a funny profile or something?
No, not at all. You don't know. So, yeah, the thing is, for some reason, the Special Forces dudes actually want to, like, know why they're doing stuff. What amazes me is nobody else is asking the same questions. Like, it takes, like, Rambo to ask, like, why are we doing this? This is like some... He's like, what
interesting.
And you read the story, it's like the guy's like, well, you know, it would be really nice if we... He's like, he's pleading to the industry, please tell us why your computers tell us to do things. It's like, no, you're supposed to be the customer. Like, gee. So there's some real cool stuff if you're interested.
And by the way, you used the wrong term there. You're not the customer, you're the consumer.
That's correct. Well, I think in many cases they are the product. Because the corporations, the big business sort of manipulates DOD to the point where they just keep sending the money. So I think they're the product at that point. Any of you guys know about Darklang? So Darklang is a favorite topic of mine. I interviewed Paul Bigger about a year and a half ago. The idea is they're building a web scalable operating system using F#. So write code just for F# and it runs anywhere in the cloud. Cool stuff. And they've been doing this for the last 3 or 4 years. They started with, I think, OCaml, and they wanted to go to Rust. And then Paul made the decision, no, F# is probably a better choice than Rust. And so he spent the next 2 years, they just finished it up, redoing the entire engine in F#. Some cool lessons here.
Well, and they were able to lift a lot of code, which probably helped them.
Yeah, OCaml looks similar to F#.
Oh, OCaml is very similar to F#. But I'm talking about in terms of if you're going to be running this on your own, there's quite a bit that you can lift out of, let's say, Mono.
I was interested exactly in where he said that the timeline, you got to read the timeline, because several times he's like, yeah, we're just a few weeks from being done, and it goes on for like 2 years of him going, yeah, any day now we're going to be finished. I'm like, oh man, I feel this pain.
The really bizarre thing about if you were going to start looking at the Mono code base in order to be able to move it forward is that Mono has moved drastically. So Mono was originally a CLR implementation that would run in, let's say, Linux.
Yes, I used it back in the day.
Today, it's mostly focused on devices.
I didn't know that. So .NET for devices, still the .NET guys, right?
Oh, that's kind of questionable if they're the .NET guys. But yeah, it can run on Android, it can run on iPhones, it can run on... The ability to use Mono in all of those different ways would actually be quite interesting.
Yeah, but I guess what I'm trying to get to is the purpose of the Mono project is to implement the common language runtime, Microsoft implementation language, in various platforms, and you're saying they're moving off to hardware now, right?
Well, no, that was the original goal. Okay. Their goal changed as they started trying to productize things.
I thought you just said the target changed, but you mean the entire purpose of the thing changed?
Yes.
Dang.
So originally, Mono was supposed to be like, we have the .NET runtime. You can run it in Solaris.
Sure. This was
cool.
It was open source. This was a selling point, yeah.
But over time, things changed. And it's largely become the main goal of Mono is to let you write .NET applications that run in Android.
Hmm. That's a similarity. I mean, they're moving from Linux to a sort of compiled proprietary type deal, right?
Well, yeah, but they've also basically given up on the entire, you know, running on Linux thing.
Well, because of Microsoft, right? Microsoft moved in with .NET Core, and it's like, okay, well, the room empties out, right?
Well, and I'm guessing that Miguel was hired there might have had something to do with it. And
Hey, look, Microsoft's here. Time to leave, dudes. Yeah, this is... The timeline just cracks me up. It's like, yeah, we're going to be done another... My goal is to finish in September, he said, like 10 months ago. Oh, man. It hurts. I think what he did, he blogged as he went along, and so he could go back and see all the lies he told himself throughout the process.
What I really laugh about with mono is that mono was at certain points much more advanced than .NET.
Hmm. They had some tough problems, as I recall correctly, in the beginning.
Well, but they could do things that .NET could not do. Like, it was impossible to do in .NET.
Hmm.
Perfect example. I want to produce a statically linked binary.
That's correct. I remember building those. As a matter of fact, I remember preferring to build them because of being out in Linux and not knowing what the hell was going on. Yeah. I don't know. I don't.
And you could do this with Mono. Like, you could actually release code that was written in C# that did not have on that operating system that you're going to install upon a CLR or anything like this. It would produce a statically linked binary that you could just run directly.
That's a good point, Greg. They don't have that now. The Mono moved off, and .NET does not provide static linking. So you can run .NET, you know, on Linux now, but you got to have the rest of the .NET stuff with you. I've really been wanting to write some Android apps for a while. I just haven't got into it. It looks like fun. Yeah, iOS as well. iOS has got the like 3 or 4 different major dev environments. To be honest, I can't think of something I want to write. And until I get excited about a project, I'm just not going to go out there. I mean, it's going to be like a week just struggling through the tools. But why? Unless there's some kind of issue you want to scratch or something, it's just no reason to do it. Okay, guys. So next up is the Trilobites have inspired a new form of camera. There's a little trilobite.
Yeah, trilobite.
Yeah, trilobite.
Trilobites are cool.
Yeah, they don't have a BYTE, but go ahead.
Yeah, I remember it was one of my favorite fossils that I found as a kid. And when we were in Morocco last October, went to a place where they've got crazy fossils, and they make beautiful sinks and countertops and tons of trilobites, including.
Oh, way cool. I can see that. That's awesome.
Yeah. And they had one, I'll upload the picture, but they had one that actually had legs and, you know, was so delicate that it was, I didn't get that these were cheap.
Yeah.
But really cool. They had some that were like this big and then one you could see the eyes.
Oh, wow.
That's what this is talking about, like this insane. Like, I don't know, these are like some really bizarre creatures.
If you get the picture, please send it to me. I'd like to put it on the block because this is, they're neat little creatures.
Yeah.
But surprisingly, trilobites never took pictures. As far as we know, they didn't have cameras. However, they had multifaceted eyes that allowed them to see. So they used the trilobite eye design to develop a camera.
Perhaps they had slightly different cameras.
Yeah, how would you make a camera for a creature with multiple eyes? Because you just couldn't show a picture to that creature. It would not look like reality.
That's an interesting thought.
Yeah.
Yeah, how would a trilobite, how does a fly look at a photograph?
Yeah, you don't see a lot of flies going to drive-in theaters, and there's a reason for that. Yeah. Probably never ask yourself that question, but there's a reason. So what they managed to do with this trilobite camera design is have a depth of field from 3 centimeters to like 3 miles. So if you know anything about cameras, that is amazing. And this will allow them to do is make little cameras on a chip that don't need lenses. So you just like pick up a chip and move it. It's something like we have here with my Logitech, but about like 1,000 times more cool.
What I'm kind of curious about is what this technology might offer in terms of satellites.
You think the bugs would want to go into space, or?
I'm pretty sure they wouldn't survive very long, but.
Yes, could have been what happened to them. They all built rockets. That's why they don't run. But what do you mean, the focused depth of field thing for the satellites, right?
Correct.
Seems like everything would be far away if you were a satellite.
Pretty much. So for the killer satellite about to clobber you.
You'd want a sharp picture of that, like to send home, yeah.
Well, it kind of also depends which direction are you pointed.
I do not. Space pretty big. You're gonna be far from about anything, I think. Unless, like John said, there's a killer satellite like next to you, in which case you want like a nice shot. Maybe you got a ray gun or something.
But if you're pointed away from the, things are very far to very, 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 very far away from you.
They are.
You could be interesting.
You're very, 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 very far. Yes, that's the other. They speaking of telescopes, they've talked about deploying the next generation scope into deep space, and it would be like multiple James Webb scopes connected by interferometry. So you end up with like a scope with a 2,000 meter baseline, which would be awesome. That this will happen a long time after I'm gone, but it'll be really cool when it does.
Yeah, like that one, the technique they used to spot the black hole with multiple now this is on the Earth, but multiple observation points that mathematically, you know, they could factor in the Earth spinning and, you know, the location, the refraction of the, you know, that's how they could get sort of like multiple eyes or multiple perspectives on some part of space.
Yeah, that's
and imagine.
That's what they were talking about with this thing. It's like computational photography. So there's like what we grew up with was lenses and film or whatever. But now it's like you take multiple pictures, then you computationally figure out what the image should be, which is not what we're used to.
Right.
Any of you guys into transhumanism or the great singularity? So transhumanism is, hey, dudes, we're all going to stop being human at some point. The great singularity is that computers are going to become so smart, it's not going to really matter whether we're humans or not. We're going to reach a point in which we cannot, which we would not recognize today as being human. I would argue that probably people from 2,000 years ago would not think of us as human. I mean, we've already at that point for other people. It's just that process will continue.
Well
the really interesting point when you go down that line is that humans will eventually build the thing that replaces them.
That's correct. And the thing is that I think we think of this as being an atomic thing. It's probably much more a gradual thing over like 50 years or 500 years. It's not going to be like an off-on deal. I don't think we'll.
Who knows? There's the Matrix, which says it's about 50 years.
I believe the Matrix.
Yeah, have either of you ever visited Pompeii?
No, I have not.
So, you know, it was like captured in time in whatever, 79 AD when it was, you know, obliterated or buried. And if you go there now, okay, you know, our main streets don't have sewage going down the center. They have sewage going underneath the street. We have bakeries. We've got public baths. We've got entertainment centers.
Whoa. Where are you going that you're going to public baths?
Well, public bathrooms.
Yeah.
Like places to...
San Francisco.
Yeah. You know, we've got fast food joints, you know, with hot steam tables and you can get food. And that's all right, you know, as you walk the streets of Pompeii, like that's all right there. Plus that's where like Beware of Dog, you know, the mosaic of the dog is, it's in front of someone's door. My thoughts going through there is, wow, we're not as advanced as we think we are.
I believe, sure. Yeah, both of those statements. Yeah, I believe, I'm with you, John, but the weird thing is that we don't see the parts where we've changed. We just see the similar parts, right?
Sure. Good point.
They found this stone from 2,000 years ago in Britain last week, and it was from the Roman occupation. They dug up this stone, and it had a dick drawn on the side with Severus as an asshole. written in Latin on the side of the stone from 2,000 years ago.
Wow. Yeah, like I rest my case. We haven't changed. That's really funny.
But you figure somebody had to take the time with a chisel. It's not, that's not the bathroom wall. This guy took like all day. He must have really not like Severs very much. I think the basic human meat sack is still the same, but if you took somebody from 2,000 years ago and showed them our life, it would not be recognized to be human to them. We don't gather water, we don't cook our food, we interact with these magic light boxes. These are not human activities for somebody to,
we fly.
Yeah, we
cover vast distances. We can go up into space near the stars. We've actually been to the moon. Yeah.
True. They would think of us more as god children than humans are people who suffer and die from measles when they're 15 or whatever. We would look like humans to them. But see, to us, looking back, it's like, oh, all this stuff is still the same and we're all the same and everything's the same. It's like, yeah, a lot is the basic human model is the same, but life for us is not anything it was like it was in BC 1000 or something.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, so I think the transhumanism is actually where we're starting to hack our own bodies, which is really crazy.
And I'm just going to throw out really quick that yet somehow I'm pretty sure it's a majority of people today still go back and read texts that were written there in order to make their moral judgments.
I would not trust Severus. I can tell you that right now. I learned that from last week. Yeah. Well, yeah, Greg, I will defend people. I'm a good agnostic. I don't know what I believe, but I know I don't believe it. You know, the thing is that moral stories have to be allegory anyway, because you can't tell somebody what to do. You shouldn't tell somebody to do. So you have to tell them a story about what things were like and what the right decision was. So it's going to be a parable, an allegory, no matter what. I tell you right now, it was told 2,000 years ago, it's the same thing. You don't want an instruction book. It's always going to be some kind of bullshit that very practical people are not going to understand. They're like, oh no, wait a minute, you know. What was the old saying? Somebody said that the Bible tells us that we shouldn't, I don't know, should have peace with the communists or something. And I think George Will asked, what was Jesus's policy on nuclear missile deterrence? He's like, no. He's like, he did not have one. That's not what these moral instructions, they're not like practical. You're supposed to do that. That's the work you have to do, right? So Diego sent us another story here. It is, they injected mice with this little chemical and turned them into young mice. It's the Benjamin Button effect. You know, we had a story, couple months ago about hamsters cannot get drunk. No matter how much you give them, for some reason hamsters are immune to getting drunk. Now we got the mice. Mice who live forever. There was also a story this past week that scientists, by doing some genetic breeding, had made hamsters, I think it was hamsters as well, super aggressive. So we're going to have immortal combat hamsters to deal with here. We don't have enough problems already. So long and short of it is there, I think they are coming along quite well in hacking the system. My best guess is that each of us might get an extra 4 or 5 years of life based on what the sufferer's doing on average. I don't think we're going to like become Superman or drunken hamsters, but you know, there's going to be some real benefits, I think, in our lifetime.
Oh, come on. You forget that it's an exponential curve.
It is. And we're doing better than we were even 100 years ago.
I want to say that our life expectancy has actually peaked and declined a little bit recently. Just some recollection I have of reading something.
They did this study of average ages of the oldest person or something like that. And it's like, it's sort of straight curve up to about 70. And at 70, there's this little bump. So between 70 and 80, there's a big chance of dying. And after 80, it kind of flattens out to about 100. And it just becomes zero. So nobody is ever going to live past, you know, 115, 120. because there's something, there's some curve there. They don't know what it is, but you're just not, you can show mathematically it's just not going to happen. So we don't.
I thought it was something called, was it apoptosis or something? Like some kind of, the cells can only replicate like 50 times. There's a counter. You know, I don't know. I'm just probably, you know, butchering what I remember. But it was, I thought it was something like that. Yep. Where that's the limiting factor is it's just not an infinite number of because your cells constantly have to replace and replenish and, you know, die and be rebirthed, I think.
There have been sci-fi movies about this, but we are not within the realm of impossibility of transferring mind. Where physical bodies no longer become important.
Mm.
It's, this was your physical body for those years, and now you have a new physical body.
There you go.
Yeah, Greg, I'm going to agree. I'm shocking. I'm going to agree with you. I think that seeing what we've been seeing, like on the roundup and just being computer guys, I think what we're going to see pretty quickly is people who have a strong social media presence will be able to be imitated by computers. Such that they can continue to message. I'm serious. I'm not bullshitting. So they still have conversations with these people long after they're gone. That's pretty weird.
I can see that.
Yeah, someday, hundreds of years from now, I will be telling corny jokes to new generations of nerds.
Right.
Mwahahaha. But yeah, I agree with Greg. I think that I think it's called telerines that decrease every time.
Telomere.
It's apoptosis that does that. That's one theory. There's another theory that there's a general breakdown in cells. It's probably a combination of all of that. But I guess what I was trying to say was, up until now, we've been pretty good at keeping people from getting sick. But there's still some limit. Like, we just run out of something. And we see that. So we're now trying to work on whatever that something is. And we've only been doing it for about 10 years or so, so that's going to have a big impact if we can figure out what it is.
Oh, come on, Daniel. You know you're going to be a toaster in, like, 37 years.
I told the kids I want a statue. I want, like when I die, I want them to build a statue in the cemetery that moves and talks. And I can tell, they can program it with all my stuff, and I can tell jokes. And it would be awesome. I don't think they're going to do that, but I just still think it would be awesome. Yeah.
You don't want, like, a robot sitting in the corner?
Fucking A, man. I want to be there, like, hey, you know, hey. But I don't want to be in the house because I get annoying enough, like, when I'm alive. So just put me off somewhere you can go visit every now and then.
Okay. All right. So you're at least giving that courtesy. All right.
Oh, my God, yes. Yeah, I wouldn't do that to I like my kids too much. So, John, have you heard of this C4 model visualization stuff? I sent you a link to that earlier. This is a guy on Hacker News said, hey, why aren't we using software to model graphics to model our software development? Because it seems like a good idea. Why doesn't anybody do this? And they mentioned C4, and I'm like, well, you know, that is kind of a good idea. Why don't we use drawing tools to model software anymore?
Yeah. No.
So have you used C4 or the DoDAF or any other things?
No.
It's just a whole bunch of different ways for drawing such shit. C4 is 4 different kinds of diagrams. I think UML has 23. The DoD architecture.
Oh, come on. UML has at least 10 times that much.
Maybe now. But yeah, there's, I don't think 23 types of diagrams. Things in the diagram, I don't know. DoDAF, the Department of Defense Architecture Framework, I think has a 5+1 modeling kind of system. We got modeling systems.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the software system container component, I could go rummage around in my cubby hole and pull out stuff I did for, you know, the IBM manufacturing execution system in the mid-90s with exactly that. I mean, a lot of things is very recursive. You don't need a ton.
I think the key message here is that with a few ideas, you can create really complicated. You don't need a bunch of ideas, but we continued, like Greg was saying, just building stuff.
Yeah.
I have a black widow spider over here. Go on, little spider. Hey, buddy. Come after me.
Deer.
Jumping spider. Multi-eye thing. Those really cool ones.
Oh, little red hourglass black spider. I believe that is a black widow.
Oh, then that was she used to kill?
No. I just kicked it under the rug. It'll be fine.
You still try to get it to go away.
I don't get a lot of visitors. I don't get a lot of visitors here, Greg. I'm like, hey, hang out, have some fun. I made espresso. So this is a good discussion. If you guys are watching this interested, there's a link here to the Why Aren't Code Diagrams Tools Made More Common? And a bunch of people talking here. And it says, it's funny because it said, well, you know, you have to do more than just boxes and lines. And it's like, well, yeah, you do, but it's more important that you have some scalable system of formality than it is to adopt one thing or the other. You're looking at this the wrong end.
Yeah, I still believe in it. I still do it. Yeah. But yeah, it's seems to be a lost art.
Boxes and lines work very, very well for most things.
Yes, boxes and arrows are a bad representation for a complex system with detailed relationships. Okay, so yes, if you're going to study the diagram, but who in the hell is going to look at a 4,000 boxed and lined, perfectly drawn? You know, no. You're going to take one part of it and talk about that. So just draw that freaking part and talk about it.
Oh my god! Now I want to do this. I want to go build the entire box and line diagram.
Yeah, I saw it. This was like a sequence diagram.
Why won't this focus?
I don't know.
Oh, it's some blurs on.
Get some New Year's Eve thing going on here. Whoa!
Kind of blur.
Ossifer, I had two drinks, Ossifer.
How I unblur myself.
You know, I have seen big complex diagrams used on the wall as like kind of a roadmap to go have a discussion. But the hell if you're ever going to use something that complex like every day to do something with. It's not the thing they want it to be because it's changing all the time.
So well, I actually used to use this as an exercise for people talking about their code and dealing with coupling.
Hmm.
So one thing that we would do is we would start putting up little cards that would represent things inside of their code and what they are related to. You would put a string between the tack one thing to the tack of the other.
We did this with user stories. Yep.
And watch them start putting these things up on the wall. Let's imagine we spent 4 to 8 hours on this. And they have this giant tangled mess sitting up on the wall.
Yes.
And it's like, well, have you guys understood the problem yet?
Yeah, we don't have enough yarn. Need more cards.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, the answer is there's some things you do. It's not an all or nothing. It's not It can serve different purposes at different times.
Yes.
One of which is a much better way to converse about concepts, to me anyway, is in diagrams.
Yes.
It's a way to create, I think, a foundation and especially the domain model and a language with which you talk about elements that end up being in your code.
Yes.
And this is a funny, I just happened to run across this, but this was a funny reverse engineering of a sequence diagram for this fairly monolithic. This is a search app. I mean, it was a method for search. I actually had to limit how many classes it could call out because it just failed. Because it's
oh wow,
it's
dodgy. Oh my god.
Right? Wow. So I you know, for when I first tried to run it. It just, you know, after a while consumed because it tried to draw, you know, all of the calls.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that's, I'm not going to say that happens because you didn't stop to maybe draw some sketches model your shit.
Yeah.
Instead, you just wrote fucking millions of lines of horrible code in one method and had no idea that maybe you should pull this out and stick it somewhere else, and maybe right.
To be fair, given the length of the document that you have there, I'm guessing they had the opposite problem—a million lines of code in one method.
Well, yeah, but every line called a different object, so it's like you had the huge method. But I think what Greg, I'm agreeing with both of you. Greg was saying was like, hey, you know, yeah, you do the boxes and lines or whatever kind of model you want, but you do that in service of not building a big piece of complex shit. What these guys right. seem to be saying is, we've already built a big complex piece of shit. Let's draw pictures of it. It's like, no, you're doing this the backwards way.
That was a value of TogetherSoft back in the day. We could reverse engineer and then maybe start to tease it out. I used to keep, I lost them over the years. I kind of thought of them as Rorschach tests. I would keep the little thumbnail views of people's code, you know, because sometimes it would be long, just like, oh my gosh, they're, what, you didn't see an inheritance you didn't want? And then sometimes super flat and wide. So that might be a little better, and other times nicely shaped. So after the fact, you could at least look at your system, but it's way better to try to infuse some of those ideas up front, and that's really...
This is the worst way of describing women I've ever heard.
You know, I was talking to Bob a few years ago, and he'd been to some conference. I forget what it was. I'm like, Bob, did you get anything interesting from the conference? He said, yeah, he said, I went to a seminar or a presentation. The guy talked about seeing whether code was good or not by the shape. Like you could blur out the lines. You could just look at the shape and see. I thought, hey, that's kind of a cool idea.
You can. I remember one company said they were, you know, that they were having some issues and they wanted me to, you know, come in. And I saw I would usually instruct these folks, all right, give me what you got. Rather, you know, if you can... even an entity relationship diagram. Just have something ready so I come in the room, we can, you know, talk about and look at things. I remember, like, that particular case, I swear, you know, 20 feet away, I'm like, oh, wow, I bet you have performance problems. And they did. You know, and then, so sometimes you can, that's why I was describing these as Rorschach blobs. I used to keep them because they actually did indicate from a distance likelihood of having problems.
I'm going to give a bit of a shout out here to Patrick, who makes Endepend.
What's it called?
Endepend.
So it basically brings a lot of these metrics over your code that you can look at it in pretty charts and things along those lines.
Charts.
Yeah, we built. I only wanted a couple of metrics in TogetherSoft that I liked. So, you know, I pretty much built things in the tool that I wanted to use and other people liked it. So it sold really well. And some of the metrics, like we've talked about here before, cyclomatic complexity is one of my favorites. Yep. But even goofy things like number of indentation, there's silly things too. In addition to unfortunately, the genius Russian developers that we had, you know, like, I think really wanted to impress me, did tons of research, and I ended up with like 60 metrics and audits. And I was like, oh my God, now I got to tell people who are going to ask me, like, what do you think the Kokomo number should be? Beats the shit out of
me. A very fun one to run across code bases is, what percentage of your calls are virtual?
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah, I think we had those kinds of counts as well. Yep.
Feathers, we know this guy named Feathers, some weird dude. We were talking about checking out.
He's not actually named Feathers. He wears feathers in his hair.
Okay, it's whatever.
Haven't you met Mike? I mean, come on.
What he was talking about, it was a cool idea, looking on GitHub to see for one code unit how many times he's been checked out for maintenance over the past 3 years. The idea being that if it's not being checked out to be maintained, it's probably pretty good code. But if it's being checked out every week, there might be something wrong with it. But that was a cool metric.
It could also just be changing.
Yeah, but the thing is that you... Yeah, I guess. I don't know. That's an interesting question. do you want code not to change? I would want to go do some other things in my life. I don't want to like be the guy who wrote PK Zip and has to do Zip the entire rest of his life. No.
Well, there is the, I remember one time we're stabilizing maybe the IBM MES C++ code base. Somehow my recollection is the IBM folks had offered to do a lot of the testing and things like that above and beyond what we did, you know, beta and certain and whatnot. And then there was something about, as the number of bugs discovered diminishes, you know, things are getting good. And I just said, well, only if you can correlate that to the number of tests going on, because if nobody's looking at it or touching it, there also won't be any bugs.
Yes.
You know, like, no, that's just not, that's.
And if it's, so not, I think being, if it's not being used, there won't be bugs, right? It's bug free.
Let me give a reasonable counterexample here. A reasonable counterexample would be something like Uber. So I'm pretty sure Uber is reasonably good at accepting people wanting rides and connecting them to cars. Hmm. But the vast majority of their business problem is, how do we connect them?
Hmm. It's true. So it's a difference. There's more people using the features that actually, that are less of the features, right? The biggest part, the hardest part of the features are centralized. What's your point here, Greg?
Well, the features are also not necessarily materially good or materially bad.
They're just special?
So you could put forward this feature in 2017, and it's actually good, and it makes everything better. Mm-hmm. But in 2019, it could actually be bad.
I used to, one of the things I ask people is, how much value does a line of code have? And the answer is almost nothing. There's no guarantee it has any value at all. Then I ask, okay, how much cost does a line of code have? And the answer is, it could be infinite. You have no idea. It could be zero. It could be, you look at it every day for the rest of your career. You don't know. So you have really, who knows the upside, but an almost infinite downside. I can see John with a perplexed look on it.
Yeah.
Get your golf clubs out, bud. We're going to code golfing. But another thing is that more code does not necessarily mean more features, is the point. So you can take a small amount of value and throw a million lines of code. You've just made yourself an idiot at that point.
But one of the things that we used to teach and practice is, there are usually very clear-cut, high-value features.
Yes.
Like, for a mortgage application, there's probably a handful of features that actually turn a bunch of stuff into money, let's say. So you could, in theory, place some value on certain parts of the code, and that is, of course, what product management should do. Placing value on features, because it trickles down into the code. It trickles down into what's the code density to get that value out. Cool thought. But
people want features. People want the code to do something. They want behavior. For some reason, our industry, we want to talk about structure, how it looks and what we've used to build it, and the nails and the hammers and blah, blah, blah. People want features. They don't give a shit about the structure. But we are obsessed with little pieces of the structure, and so we ended up rebuilding all sorts of structures that are not related to the value of the features or how much the structure should or should not. That's how we end up with 230 megabytes to download to do the upload. That's as exact, because nobody cares about the, oh, it's just uploading a file.
Well, that's because there must not have been, you would think there wasn't any sort of ROI involved. Yeah, because apparently no one cared.
Well, not just ROI, but the thing is, he's using a library that's, people have just conglomerated over the years with all kinds of bullshit for every sort of feature in the world. He just needs this one feature. So he's got to pull this spaghetti monster out to get the one thing he wants. It's not that they're not looking at his need. It's like, to get his need, he has to, like, fulfill the needs of 4,000 other people who touched the code at some point. It's like, no, that's just too much coupling.
Yep.
Why are you denigrating the flying spaghetti monster at all of this? That seems completely unfair.
Yes.
Yeah. I want to make a pitch for the ball of mud.
Ball of mud, people. Very important. So, have any of you guys used Emacs in your career?
As close as I got, I think maybe, but as close as I got was one of the guys, I remember Dave Estelles, that I hired at TogetherSoft, so this is going 20 years or so, and he was an Emacs junkie and said, like, would you use anything else? This can do everything. That's all my recollection about Emacs is. You can make it do everything and anything.
I keep wanting to use it. It's a complexity hump with the keyboard cords. This guy talks about why Emacs has buffers. It turns out there are people using Emacs, which there's probably tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. This is 60-year-old decisions in software that people are still getting value out of. It just amazed me. That you could, I would love to write a piece of software that people are using 60. I would just dream of that. It'd be awesome.
Well, yeah. What I mostly look for is people who use Emacs and people who use Vim, and I try to get them in the same room together.
Woo-hoo, make them fight.
I'm sure the Emacs person would say, "Oh, I can make a Vim replica if you want it."
Yes. Emacs can do anything.
Oh, come on. The Vim people will say the same thing about Emacs.
Yeah. And then people have a Vim plugin so that Emacs runs like Vim. And I don't even understand that shit, because that's like Presbyterians and Baptists getting together. It's just something wrong with that.
Yeah. Shift-CZ. That's the only thing I need to know.
How do I get out of this thing? This next story is
Escape, colon, Q.
It's true. Yeah, it's too hard.
Yes. That's the first thing it pops up on the screen, is to tell people how to quit, because that's what everybody wants to know.
How the hell do I get out of this thing?
The number one thing Googled about your software, how do I leave?
Right.
So this is a long article. I did not get a chance to. I just read the first few paragraphs. It boils down to, this guy was interested, does malloc actually cause a big hit in performance? Because we've all been taught that. You don't just go throwing out memory requests all the time because you're going to fuck up everything. He's like, you know, is that still true? And he goes, does this long thing. He's like, I don't know. I think maybe the hardware's gotten to the point, at least for audio processing, doesn't really matter anymore. CPU is so fast, you're not going to notice the difference.
Yeah, I think I mentioned this before, and the book is somewhere up in my attic. I should go get it at some point. That just for shits and grins, when I was writing a C and C++, I did crazy benchmarking about stuff like that. Malloc, and wasn't there a C alloc? And wasn't there, you know, different ways to print? And I would do stuff just to test, hey, I wonder if the C++ way of printing is, you know, is faster than this or that. And yeah, nowadays, you probably don't have to care nearly as much as back in those days.
Well, you know, the file uploading thing, you know, I was talking about the file uploading being a line of JavaScript and a couple lines of server code. Of course, it wasn't always like that. When the web first came out, you'd have to write hundreds of lines of stuff. But the providers start building in stuff that are commonly used, but we still keep these libraries and ideas from 10, 20 years ago. So I thought this was a kind of a good double check on, hey, wait a minute, we still need to be doing all this stuff. Okay, this is next one is Tools for Better Thinking, bunch of really cool consulting tools. So if you do like squishy stuff, like, you know, tell me about your feelings, let's do a puppet show. This is some good stuff like that. I use many of these tools myself, and I make fun of that because this is the kind of stuff I do. So conflict resolution diagrams, Kinefin. Hey, see, you're not making real money unless you're saying Kinefin every now and then, because people don't know what the fuck you're saying. They're like, what? Yeah, it's Kinefin, dude, man. We do a lot of Kinefin here. Connection circles, Eisenhower matrix. There's also the quality function deployment, which you didn't have here. I can think of probably three or four ones that you could have added. Six thinking hats.
I've seen that one before.
Yeah, I do the three thinking shoes. Not as popular. I don't know if he's got the five whys, maybe. I have the seven what system. And the seven what system is you just keep saying what until people go away.
Until they go away.
Stop the doing this. The server's down. What? It's not working. Right. What?
That's just a...
What?
That's the hillbilly cousin to the five whys.
Yes, it's the hillbilly cousin, yes. Along with the three thinking shoes, which is because you can't, like, tie the shoe. It's or count. Hard choice model. Well, that's a good one, too. If you click on this, it says, yeah, it's stop, bub. Buck up. That one. Okay, so we'll get to the fun stories. For the third time, classified specifications of a war thing has been leaked on this War Thunder forum. In this case, it's classified specs for a Chinese tank. And they dumped the whole book of specs here. And this has happened for American stuff, too. These guys love playing the game so much, they're like dumping all the stuff to each other to like get the game better.
Isn't that funny?
Oh, wow. It's like, hey, cool. That's just amazing.
I'm kind of surprised that, I shouldn't say surprised, that U.S. intelligence has not been deliberately doing this.
That's what I was thinking. Like, this would be like best job ever. Set up some really cool game and just watch people dump classified stuff.
Yeah.
And this is totally the kind of thing U.S. intelligence would do.
And the beauty of it, it's using the Chinese culture against them because they really don't care that much about IP or secrets or any of that stuff. It's like, hey, we got a cool game. Let's just throw whatever we got out there. It's like, yeah, we'll take that. It's good. Just keep it coming.
That's fine.
In order to get to your next level, we need to know the precise bevel of this part of
Yeah, special Russian game. Just put in your location of your missile launcher, and we give you like a free virtual sword. So, last story. This guy was on GitHub. They were doing the sign-up process for Epic Games. They had a bug. And the guy said, oh, I think I've got this fixed. I'll send out a PR to their notification to say that it's bug fixed. And the other guy goes, you know, I think you just emailed 398,463 people. Oopsie. yeah, that's oopsie.
400,000. The best though is if you go back in time, there are quite a few situations where you can find a CEO who has done the same.
Mm-hmm. Have you guys run into Google? If you put like 20 people on your to list. Like, oh, hang on, no. You can't do like 20 people at one time. You could be spamming them. But you
can. I would blame, certainly, anything, any system that allowed that to happen. Yes. I blame the system.
Yes.
Not the person. Like, wait, are you sure you want to spam this many people? Yep. How did it happen?
They all subscribed to see what was going on with Epic Games being updated, the code, and it's just, nobody ever thought of notifying the entire list. It's hilarious. And they didn't get mad at the guy. It was like, okay, I guess these things happen. No big deal. That's just wild.
Some of the comments.
What else are you going to say at that
point? I don't know. I have no idea.
I'm just going to sit back with some popcorn and enjoy the madness. Does anyone have any brownies? Yeah. Brownie recipes? Yeah.
The funny thing is that I talk to guys who set their email servers, and it's the dickens to try to get an email server for you personally to send email because of all the spam problems. But yet, if you go through some little back door accidentally, there you are talking to 400,000 people.
Right. That is really funny.
Okay, guys, so what have you been consuming this week?
Well, as I mentioned, Stranger Things.
Very good.
And you're right. It was very 80s. It's pretty funny. Love the Pinto, AMC Pacers.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
And I'm sure even things down to the chips they're eating, the soda cans, a lot of things you can tell are the cassettes.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so it is an ode to the 80s. It's pretty funny. It
felt like being back home growing up. And some of that was like, oh, wow, I remember this stuff. This is awesome. Radio Shack was in there. It's like, everyone probably, hey, Radio Shack.
Yeah, and I think, I did Heathkit radios, ham radios and stuff like that. And I think that's one of their things.
I had serious lust over those big walkie-talkies. They had like five channels or five. I mean, I really, really wanted one growing up. And those little kids are carrying like, oh, wow, that's so nice. Of course, now it doesn't. There's nothing. But back then, it was like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
How about you, Greg? You been reading any books?
I've mostly been consuming FedEx Passport Service.
How is the passport thing going?
It's not.
Fuck, sorry.
It's not moved forward at all.
Did they lose it?
No, they supposedly have it in an office somewhere.
Oh, that's
a hostage? We have passport.
I'm just waiting to get the ransom letter.
Is it in Stockholm?
Yeah, I bet you the ransom letter gets there overnight, buddy. I'm sorry to hear that. That's a damn shame.
Dear sir, I am locked up in a closet. If you provide $1 million, get me out of this closet.
Here's a picture of your passport next to like the current newspaper, so you can make sure like a proof of life.
Right.
I'm sorry to hear that, Greg. It's your speedy passport service has been anything but speedy. Maybe you should have tipped the driver or something.
Yeah.
And the crazy
I should learn next time. The only problem is that you don't actually tip the driver with FedEx. You normally bring it to their office. I should have tipped the girl in the office, which is happened.
That's it.
Yeah, there you go. You got to learn who's Palms to grease.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? Today, I've got a tip for her. Don't eat yellow snow.
Watch out where the huskies go.
So if I go to the post office, am I going to see like a picture of like Greg the Jackal on the wall? Like
Greg in a FedEx passport bag.
So I started watching today. I watch stuff while I'm coding in for lunch and keeps me company. I watched Slow Horses, and I watched 6 hours of that the other day, and I don't know what the fuck happened. The whole season one, they didn't have horses. I know that was about spies, and they argued a lot, and there's some shootings, and I have no idea. I was coding. I was like, okay, I just needed the noise. But today, for lunch, I started watching For All Mankind on Apple TV. Very cool. It is an alternate history. Starts with Neil Armstrong and the Apollo 11 program. And says, okay, what if the Russians actually beat us to the moon? What would happen then? And it's just,
that's an interesting question.
It is very, very cool stuff. If you love like the right stuff and space stuff, it's full of stuff like that. Yeah, it's very most enjoyable. Okay, guys, I'll do the adios thing. Hang on a second. Okie dokie. Well, there we are. You've wasted yet another hour on Nerd Roundup. We're really happy you dropped by. I'm Daniel Markham. I'm at danielbmarkham.com. I will see you on the internet.